court is ready to hear argument in 040493 in the interest of KAF, a child.
May I please report to the jury the comments that have been argued in the
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, I would like to first discuss this morning whether a motion to modify the judgment will extend the appellate timetable for an accelerated appeal. And then in any time remaining, I would like to discuss what we consider to be the various serious constitutional issues that are raised in the event that the answer to that question is no. Now, generally, as civil attorneys, we have the luxury of just talking about money, whether it be the pitch of a roof yesterday or falling off a horse today. But sometimes the stakes are much more serious. And even though we have a technical construction of the rules here that we're arguing about, the ultimate import of what we're talking about is much more fundamental. I can't say it any better than this court said it in In Re MS, where it said that termination of parental rights is traumatic, irreparable, and permanent. And if there's any arguable construction of the appellate rules that will avoid the result that just hits you wrong in the gut, that you have an irreparable permanent deprivation of parental rights, that you don't have a chance to have appellate review.
How does ineffective assistance of counsel play into your argument?
I was going to get to that, but I'll jump right to it.
But if that's the principle, then no deadline will ever apply.
I don't think so.
I mean, that same argument can be made about a notice of appeal filed 100 days instead of 90 days after.
Well, if there's an arguable construction, if there's no arguable construction, as this court has said, and this court has said that our construction is at least plausible, then the deadline holds. I don't think there's anybody that argues that 90 days plus 15 in grace period of Verbert isn't a hard deadline. I mean, once you get out to 105 days, that's a hard deadline. As far as ineffective assistance of counsel, we believe that plays into it because there are a number of instances where, in analogous circumstances, courts have found that when you have such a due process deprivation, that the rules must give way. In fact, this court's found that in In Re MS, where it said preservation of factual sufficiency review must give way to the due process concerns when there has been ineffective assistance of counsel. And we think this is such a case, analogous to a criminal case where the Court of Criminal Appeals allows for out-of-time appeals for ineffective assistance of counsel, analogous to immigration appeals in the federal courts, where the federal courts have said we have an equitable tolling doctrine where there's been ineffective assistance of counsel. We think those same policies play into this case.
Do you argue that a motion to modify should have a different effect in this kind of a case than in other kinds of civil cases?
No, Your Honor. We think the rules should apply to a motion to modify judgment across the board. We find no specialist in this case as far as that's concerned until we get to the constitutional issue that it runs you into. As far as our argument is concerned on the construction of the rules, it's straightforward. Rule 26.1 sets out the general rule that you have 30 days to file an appeal. And then there are a series of exceptions. Subsection A says you file one of four post-trial motions. The deadline for filing an appeal is 90 days. Subsection B says if you have an accelerated appeal, the deadline for filing is 20 days. Rule 26 doesn't address what happens when you have both. When you have both an accelerated appeal and you have one of the four post-trial motions that has been filed. So if that were standing alone, there wouldn't be any real guidance as to whether A trumps B because it comes first or B trumps A because B has a shorter time period than A. But we can find some guidance in Rule 28, because Rule 28.1 and 28.2, referring to accelerated appeals, for interlocutory appeals, and for quo warranto proceedings, both have the same sentence in it that the filing of a motion for new trial shall not extend the time to perfect the appeal. Now, that sentence in both of those sections is to have any meaning, then subsection B of 26 can't answer the question, because that would just make those sentences surplusage. And there's some reason to think, or in fact there's substantial reason to think, from the redrafting of the rules in 1997, that those sentences were still meant to have meaning.
I'm not sure I understand.
Yes.
Doesn't 26, you think that just because there are no exceptions in B, that there might be?
Well, I'm saying there are two exceptions.
Why wouldn't you repeat the exceptions in A and B if you thought they applied?
Well, because there's two separate exceptions. I mean, that's what leads to the ambiguity. We have 30 days, and then there are two separate exceptions to the 30 days. One that says, if these four things happen, it's 90 days. Then we got a separate exception, and they don't refer to each other, says, if this other thing happens, it's 20 days. What happens when they both happen? And it just doesn't address what happens when you have both. But if Rule B trumps, then these are dead letters over here in Rule 28.1, 28.2. Were they intended to be dead letters? Is that how we are to interpret it as just erroneous surplusage? I don't think so. Because in the 1997 redraft of the rules, these sentences were specifically left in. Take a look at Rule 28.2, referring to quo warranto proceedings. That rule comes from the prior rule, 42A2. In substantially the same language said, exactly the same language says that the filing of a motion for new trial shall not extend the time to perfect the appeal. And the former rule went on to say, or the time for filing a balanced brief. Now, in the redraft of the rules, obviously the second clause was decided that should be dropped because we now peg the filing of appellant's brief from the time of filing the record, not from the time of filing the appeal. But a decision was made to keep the rest of the sentence in there. And that doesn't make any sense to preserve the rest of the sentence if it's not to have any meaning. This would have been the time to drop it as surplusage if it wasn't intended to have any meaning. But somebody thought it still had meaning, and they kept it in. And the same for 28.1. In fact, there was a more substantial revision to 28.1.
The quicker we can get these appeals decided, the better.
True.
And so why your interpretation will almost guarantee that they will be slower? Maybe not in every case, but in lots of them they will be. So the legislature in the one-year deadlines and et cetera, the legislature gave us some pretty strong indication in line with social science that the quicker who the parents are is determined, the better for the child. So why shouldn't we just have a firm rule that says, look, 20 days it is, 20 days we mean?
Because as with so many issues that hit your desk, there are competing policies. And here we have a competing policy that we do have a legislative policy to speed up accelerated appeals, and we also have a policy to preserve the appeal if there's any arguable argument to do so. And here, we don't destroy the first policy by our interpretation. It does work against it, and I have to admit that. It does work against it, but it certainly doesn't destroy it. There are other appellate tools available to speed up accelerated appeals, and one of them is in Rule 28.3. which presumably is one of the accelerated provisions that's incorporated into the Family Code by Section 109.002A, which is the statute applicable here, that incorporates generally the accelerated provisions of the Rules of Appellate Procedure into the Family Code. And 28.3, two tools that provides to appellate courts is you can accelerate the disposition on sworn pleadings without waiting for a clerk's record. You can set disposition without briefs, apparently just on argument. And there are, of course, a number of informal tools or internal tools that you can use by appellate court can use by accelerating on its docket. I know as a former staff attorney, when my judge told me to put the draft at the top of my list of things to do, that significantly accelerated the disposition of an appeal. And in this case, I know the Fifth Circuit is very reluctant to allow extensions of time on reply briefs. That's another place where it can be extended. In this case, The other side got extension time on their appellee's brief, pushing our reply brief to do right after Thanksgiving weekend. And I was very tempted to ask for an extension of time, but I didn't because it's an accelerated appeal, and I don't think you should have given it to me for a reply brief. So there are a number of tools in the arsenal to further that policy of accelerating the appeal. Conversely, the competing policy, if you say that B is the final word and it's only 20 days, then that policy is fundamentally destroyed if we lose the appeal, and despite any arguable interpretation to the contrary. And that not only does violence to that policy, it does violence to the plain language of the appellate rules in 28.1 and 28.2 by making those dead letters.
Well, it seems to me that 28 just is totally inapplicable here. If you start with 109.002A, the first words say the procedures for an accelerated appeal under the rules. So you have to decide what are the procedures, where are they set out. And really, 28 doesn't say anything about procedures as much as it does, as much as it says what may be accelerated. It says interlocutory appeals shall be accelerated, quo warranto proceedings shall be accelerated. So it seems to me 28 says what will be accelerated, but it doesn't really set forth any procedures except as those specific avenues, which would then get us back to 26. So, do you agree that 28 really has no application here?
No, Your Honor, I don't agree, and this Court didn't agree in Hone. I mean, this Court made that same analogy in Hone and said, here, take a look at 28.1. This doesn't make sense if 28.1 says this and 2.
Well, that's a different argument. I mean, you can say that in other areas of the code they've indicated they know how to shorten these times and say this won't do it. They know how to do it, and they didn't do it here. But that doesn't mean it applies here. That means that you can consult it to see if the legislature knew how to do it.
Right.
But I can't, in the language of 28, see that there has any application here other than to indicate the legislature knew how to do it, which just puts you to 26.
Well, I agree with that to the extent that I'm using 28 to inform how we interpret 26. I would disagree to the extent that 28.3 only applies to full warranto and interlocutory. The 11th say 28.3 was incorporated generally into the Family Code, and it's difficult to tell, but since the Family Code simply incorporated all the accelerated provisions in mass, if you will, without making any distinction, it seems to me a perfectly reasonable construction that they were saying that the full warranto and interlocutory appeal provisions in 28 apply to this proceeding as well.
Well, if you look at the comment to Rule 28, it says that a motion for new trial is now permitted in an appeal from an interlocutory order, but it does not extend the time to perfect appeal. That indicates to me that previously you weren't even allowed to file these post-judgment motions, but we amended Rule 28 to allow at least a motion for new trial, but to clarify that that would not. You now have that right. The trial court can grant it and move the appeal, but it will not extend the timetable.
Yes, and as a matter of fact, I was just about to get to 28.1. It formally was language taken from former Rule 42A1, which said, in appeals from interlocutory orders, no motion for new trial shall be filed. And there was some conscious decision to change that language to make it consistent with 28.2, the pro warranto rule.
And I think the reason for that historically was if the judge had a change of heart, the trial court, there's no need to go through an interlocutory appeal if the trial court's going to reverse himself or herself. So it seemed jurisprudentially prudent to put that in there to give the trial court another chance to reconsider, but not to slow down the appeal process, which doesn't signal to me that anybody thought you had the right to file these other post-judgment motions.
Well, if you didn't have the right to file the other post-trial...
To extend the deadline.
Well, if I see the point, but the quo warranto provision was still there and left in, only referring to motions for a new trial. That still doesn't make any sense. And it really doesn't make any sense to make the two parallel, to refer to just motions for a new trial. It would make more sense, I believe, if that was the case, just to drop it out. If you dropped out the provision, the prohibition against filing motions for new trial, there would no longer be any prohibition. And it would be But by putting it in specifically and referring to motion for new trial, that would not be necessary unless subsection B of Rule 26 doesn't would otherwise allow it.
Well,
it seems
the reason we're putting it in there is that you get the motion for new trial. It can be acted on within a certain time frame, but it does not extend the timetable. Whereas if you totally prohibit it, you didn't get a motion at all, and the timetable wouldn't be extended.
But the third option is you drop it altogether, and you get your motion for a new trial. You just drop the prohibition altogether, you get your motion for a new trial.
But then it would extend the appellate timetable. So what this was, and this indicates to me that no one thought that any of these motions were available to extend the appellate timetable under 26.
Because they only chose motions for a new trial.
You didn't get one before. You didn't get anything before. And you say, they come back and say, okay, at least you get a motion for new trial to let the trial court pull it back and pull down their erroneous order. But that does not extend the timetable, the appeal timetable.
Again, I just say there's no reason to say that if Rule 26, subsection 26.1b already answers that question. You just repeal the prohibition and you've reached the policy that you're saying that the advisory committee was seeking.
Thank you. If there are no further questions, I will have some on constitutional position that you were explaining that you would take if the court were to say it didn't extend the deadline, and perhaps you can address that on rebuttal. The court is ready to hear arguments from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Richard Clarkson will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. As a caveat, let me say that I've been a longtime member of the State Bar's Committee on Legal Services to the Court in civil cases, and nothing I say today would detract from my position that the poor are entitled to legal services. Of course, the question, and what I think is the threshold question here, is a fact question. That is, what was the intent? If you take the document as written, it says, and less probable to provide the basis to a subsequent appeal. Well, less probable is less than possible, and certainly wouldn't even be admitted under Texas Rule of Evidence 401 as relevant evidence. So the threshold question is a jurisdictional question. That is, does this court have the right or jurisdiction to reach constitutional issues or statutory interpretation issues if it is must first have before it a factual finding on the intent? You know, this is not like 1984 where war is peace and love is hate and so forth. We're talking about words and phrases that have hundreds of years of jurisprudence behind them. And notice of appeal is not a difficult phrase. It doesn't mean it's possible that we might appeal sometime in the future versus we are given a present notice of appeal.
Well, we don't reach that question until we answer the first, correct?
Yes, that's right. And the case that I just filed a brief in recently in the Eastland Court was the question of whether or not a client was indigent. What the court did was abate that trial, that appeal, sent for the record, and now has before it the question of indigency and whether or not a record would be produced and then to go forward with the appeal. We have none of that here. There's no record before this court. It's all speculative. You don't know even if at the motion for new trial hearing the client, Ms. Capps, conceded that she had no intention at that time to appeal.
Well, can you address the first point as to the extension of the deadlines? I mean, how do you address the argument that in other areas the legislature and the rule, well, the rules indicate that it's clear when post-trial motions will not extend appellate deadlines. And by silence in 26.1b, there is no intent to extend. I mean, there's no intent to allow extension of deadlines.
Well, not being a scholar on statutory instruction, I went to the Sutherland's six-volume set on statutory instruction and looked it up. I saw that pari materia as a doctrine, for instance, is important. And that goes back to what is the public policy of Texas. The legislative history is available. There's a wonderful outfit here in Austin that will give that to you, legislative intent research. None of that's been done in this case. So, again, we're speculating on legislative intent. But another case that I had involving a mandamus was the fact that when the children are taken away from one or both parents, the legislature passed a new statute saying that there were 6 months only to challenge this, not the bill of review time or any other time. That it was mandatory that it be done within 6 months, and as Judge Brister, I believe, said, the public policy is that this must be done quickly.
That's when the Texas Department of Protective Services is involved, right?
No, that involves private parties. That case involved private parties. But I'm glad you mentioned that, because that is a separate distinction, which is part of this pari materia, this old statutory instruction rule. And that is, counsel wants you to look at this rule and that rule, or this statute and that statute. The rule is that it has to be of the same kind or degree. And there's the same focus, I should say. And there's case law in Texas that says the Department of Regulatory Services is different than merely two parents having a dispute about who's going to be named the managing conservator.
If you can't file post-judgment motions in accelerated appeals, how do you preserve factual sufficiency questions? If you can't file a motion for new trial, how do you preserve those?
Well, of course, that's an issue that's not been, to my knowledge, has not been resolved. One has to balance the right to get these matters taken care of quickly versus the traditional less hurried appellate process. In a regular case, one would file their bills or file their motions for new trial and so forth, which would allow a regular appeal to go on. I think the courts are saying that in an expedited appeal, some of these traditional common law rights do not exist. If the court has made the public policy decision, or the legislature has, that speed is more important in these particular cases.
Isn't that a due process problem if you lose your right to factual sufficiency review?
Well,
in a parental termination case?
I recognize that both the Texas Supreme Court and the United States Supreme Court have said the parental right in their children is a primary right that's protected by the Constitution. But the question here is whether or not there was a notice of appeal filed. Counsel has pointed to the document that they based that on. One needs no more evidence unless you abate the case and send it back to the trial court or the court of appeals for additional findings. This court and the court of appeals have the power through affidavit or remand for hearings to determine crucial factual questions that would bear upon the jurisdiction. And certainly that's a possible way to do it. But the question here is not did she fail to prove that she was a good mother. The question is, did she fail to file a notice of appeal? And we have that document in front of us. And that document is syntactically ambiguous, to speak charitably. And this lady, Ms. Capps, had a lawyer, but she testified that she and the family spent over $200,000 on the trial. So this is not a mere tyro or a mere neophyte. I would be tickled to be paid $200,000 for a child custody dispute. So we're not dealing with a person wandering blindly out in the desert, not knowing north from south. We're a person with skill, legal assistance. And the law is that before this court can reach a constitutional issue, it must adopt any set of facts which support the constitutionality of the statute under review. And in the face of no record, the interpretation is that less probable means just that, that it's less probable there's even going to be an appeal. So,
if you're just looking at 26.1, and that's all, the language itself, it doesn't say that post-trial motions will not extend the appellate deadline. From what do we imply that?
I think you have to examine this is a case where you must examine the public policy of the state of Texas.
So we would be adding public policy to the plain language of the statute.
Yes, and you do this not in a vacuum, but you do it by looking at how the legislature in the last decade or so has been dealing with all these problems. Time and time again, we read in the legislative history that the legislature is very concerned about how these cases are dragging on and on and on.
And indicated in the family code that there would be no post-trial motions when the situation is severe enough to where the Texas Department of Protective and Regulatory Services has had to step in.
Yes.
But they did not indicate that in the Family Code Section 109.002, and they easily could have.
Yes, they could have.
But you want us to engraft it, even though the legislature didn't.
Yes, I do. But that is not my only argument to the court. My argument to the court also is, and I point the court to McDonald's, which is a source that I always keep on my desk. McDonald says a motion to modify is, in effect, a motion for new trial. That's also said in the DACO decision.
Well, but regardless, if we're just looking at 26, a motion for new trial would extend the deadline as well.
Well, it's what it says is that is under A for 90 days. It's not under Section B for 20 days. The legislature.
Well, that's what we're trying to determine. I mean, there's nothing in 26 itself that says these post-trial motions will not be allowed under B.
Well, there is this. Expressio unius est exclusio alterius. That is, A
lists. Well, that can work against you as well. I mean, the expression that post-trial motions will not be allowed. The fact that that statement is not in 26.
Yes, but as I see it, if they say in A you have all these rights, and then they go to the trouble to make a Section B and don't give you those rights, that is not a stylistic decision, but is under statutory construction is a decision with a purpose, and that is if you've got 90 days, we'll let you do all this stuff. But if it's a fast appeal that must be dealt with quickly, we're not going to give you all these traditional things. Now,
if petitioner's appeal was not timely perfected, if it was not,
yes.
Why did petitioner not receive ineffective assistance of counsel and should be entitled to an out-of-time appeal?
Well, of course, that is a threshold factual question. For instance, if she said then, when she had the attorney, that, you know, the family spent this money, I don't know if we're going to be able to handle an appeal or have an appeal, and that's why they talked about less probable, and then months later changes her mind.
So you think there might be fact questions about the effectiveness of counsel that would have to be, if she's entitled to raise that issue, they would have to be examined by the trial court?
Yes. Now, here's one other point. And there's cases in the brief, and that is, for instance, the attorney filed a motion for findings of fact and conclusions of law in a summary judgment proceeding. And the court held that that didn't extend time to file an appeal because such a thing is in a posit for a summary judgment proceeding. The court doesn't give findings of fact and conclusions of law. It'd be like filing a motion to have a 6 months vacation. What does that have to do with anything?
And what would she have to prove, do you think, to show ineffective assistance of counsel?
Well, to show ineffective assistance of counsel, and I have argued these cases before, she would have to show that she did want an appeal, and she instructed her attorney to file a notice of appeal. Of course, being a layperson, she would probably use imprecise language, but that she wanted an appeal. She was not going to lightly lose her children. She'd already lost three children. This is number four. Karen is number four.
But pretty clear here. She didn't want to appeal. I mean, this wasn't a pro forma motion for new trial and motion.
It was in this sense, Judge. And this is my point about the analogy with summary judgment. She, in effect, threw herself on the mercy of the court. Here is a jury trial. And she says, oh, please, and I'm not at all belittling what she said, but she said, in effect, please, Judge, I want to have custody of my child. Won't you change this verdict and give the child to me? Now, that was her argument on the motion to modify. And they are saying that the notice of appeal is part of this motion to modify. Well, the judge cannot modify the judgment on the basis of his feeling sorry for her.
Well, but there's more than that. There's no evidence as to the best interest of the child. That's one of the positions made. I mean, there's enough in here to lead, I think, a reasonable lawyer to conclude if you see this kind of motion, then the next thing you're going to see is an appeal. She's attempting to preserve error. She's trying to get a new trial, trying to get the judge to change his or her mind, but this sets up an appeal.
Judge, I don't see. First of all, the cases hold the motion to modify is, in effect, a form of motion for new trial.
Well, it also has modification as well. I mean, it says keep my parental rights intact. You know, I can at least have visitation. So it is a modification. It's not just do it all over again.
And, Judge, I see it really as a throwing herself upon the mercy of the court. As the court knows, every time there's a jury trial, the judge tells the jurors before they go out to deliberate, do not let sympathy play a role in your decision. The same rule applies to this court. You don't rule on one side or another based upon sympathy. And that's all that this woman really had to ask the court. I am a mother.
Well, but I mean,
There was no.
You're saying that she wasn't really asking to modify. She was asking to do it all over again.
Yes.
But she really was asking to modify as well by saying, keep my parental rights intact. That's a modification.
Well, Judge, my position is that no experienced judge grants a motion for new trial based upon the pro forma recitation of there are no facts that support us, there's no law that support us. Please give
so
us.
So you agree then she was moving on the modification end to modify the judgment?
But she was asking the judge to do that, which he did not really have the power to do. And that is to throw out the jury verdict because he felt sorry for her, that he felt sympathetic to her. That's what she was asking for. Now, I think a case on this question of public policy that's important is the case out of Wisconsin, and that addresses this issue of expedited appeals. In the interest of MT and MT, in 1981 decision, Mr. Handley here, I believe, pointed out that there was some further appellate decision on the matter. But the point here is the court held that legislative history considered, statutory history considered, case law considered, it is against public policy in this state to prolong these cases, and they are cut out and treated separately on an expedited appeal. And I invite the court's attention to that case. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yes, sir.
I would point out that under Family Code Section 161.205, the court did have the power to enter any other order short of termination if the court felt the facts warranted it. So that was a relief that the court could grant an appropriate circumstance to modify the judgment. I would like to turn to the constitutional implications, if I may. I think it's appropriate to back up and say, well, why do we have appellate review to begin with? Why do we put so much stock in appellate review? Why was
Let
this
me
court?
Ask you,
sir.
Is there any threshold showing that must be made before you would be entitled to an out-of-time appeal, or would just every prospective appellant in these circumstances get one?
The threshold showing would be to show ineffective assistance of counsel under the Strickland
case. Well, if you
Washington
missed the State. Deadline and you wanted to appeal, isn't that ineffective?
Yes.
So would you ever not get it?
Not in a circumstance such as this.
And then is there any limit, any time limit, 6 months or a year?
Yes, Your Honor, there's a time limit, but there's not a bright line. There's a due process. It has to go as far, in my view, as due process requires. And due process just doesn't have very many bright lines in it. I think you would have presumptions. I would think that at some point you would have a presumption that this appellant was not really pursuing an appeal, and that after that certain amount of time, it would be very difficult to overcome that presumption. But I don't think you would have
would
a bright
say,
line.
Would you say that inquiry would be instructed by the 90-day time or 105 days, however much it is that you get in some cases?
I think all of those, plus the six-month statute that counsel mentioned, the general time it takes to dispose of an appeal.
This seems to harken back to an earlier inquiry. This seems to cut against the whole idea that these things should speed up.
It cuts against it, but as I said, I don't think it destroys it. And if it cuts against it, it cuts against it because of a greater policy issue of due process. In the RG case that we cited, the New Jersey Court of Appeals decision, in that case, over a year had gone by. I mean, they were way outside their appellate deadlines, and the court said due process simply requires us to relax our rules to allow this even after a year.
In Ray BLD, we looked at the Matthews versus Eldridge factors in due process and decided that our preservation rules are not required to be abrogated under due process. Which way does that cut for your position in this case?
Well, that would cut against me. But I believe that the court dealt with that in In Re MS and felt that a different balance came into effect when ineffective assistance deprived an appellant, in that case, of a factual sufficiency review. And a factual sufficiency review, I mean, there's probably not one case in 1,000 that gets reversed on factual sufficiency. But this court nonetheless thought it was important that that be reviewed because due process. I think it was correct because it's not that we find so much error in the trial courts on appellate review. In fact, we find very little error, comparatively speaking. What is important is we have this safety valve that adds so much legitimacy to the system to have this second set of judicial eyes. Take a look when such fundamental rights are at stake.
Were these arguments on ineffective assistance brought to the Court of Appeals?
No, they weren't. And I don't know when you are supposed to bring up ineffective assistance, when you're required to bring up ineffective assistance of counsel on appeal, when it affects an appeal. But no, to answer your question, the arguments were brought up for the first time in this court, and I have pointed to certain cases where fundamental rights are at stake. This court has gone ahead and addressed it. Thank you.
Counsel, that concludes the argument and all cases for this morning. The court will, the marshal will now adjourn.
All rise. 48.